Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications through LifeMD? LifeMD is now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
Probably the easiest thing I've ever done. The medication comes in the mail and it's very easy to use. I've been able to live my normal lifestyle and I've lost 20 pounds already and I've never felt better. It changed my life.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Histories of the Unexpected, the show in which we demonstrate that everything, simply everything, you can possibly think of has its own history, like spades, seagulls, and clutter.
Mm. I want to do clutter. I heard a podcast on clutter the other day, and it just sounded amazing, all from a sort of sociological point of view, and I thought actually what would be really interesting is looking at it from a historical point of view, but we could also do spades and seagulls, or pasta, priests and pampering, porcupines, pregnancy and potholes. Can you see, after this summer break, there's a slight variation on this theme. However, for the moment, we will be following the links in our minds as we come across them, explaining very carefully indeed how those histories link together in unexpected ways. Who knew, for example, who knew that the history of jewellery is in fact all about amulets and magical powers and animal protection via Native Americans, Tudor call lockets and unicorns? Horns. It's also all about 18th century lockets, the Mughals, courtesans and female power, the Queen's jewels and rather large diamonds. Who knew, Sam Willis? Who knew? Or who knew that the history of footsteps, yes, we've got to follow that one, is in fact all about Roman civilization, animal prints frozen in time, treading in the footsteps of the past. It's about the history of religion, pilgrims and pilgrimages, and religious routes mapped across the world from ancient times to the present. A humdinger of an episode, Sam Willis, I think you'll agree.
It was wonderful. I really enjoyed that. And it was beach-based as well, or beach-inspired, which is where we're going again today.
Yes.
Let me just introduce my fellow presenter. Let me say that if history was a slimy, stinking pile of slop, food peelings, leftover bones, fruit stones with flies buzzing around them, ready to lay their eggs as the vibrant and nuanced day-to-day life of the past rots down into a forgotten goo of misunderstood filth, this man would be history's Cooper. He would carefully hand-make a staved bucket, bound by a brass girdle of research, to collect and store that miserable bucket of uncared-for grossness so that he could carefully resurrect it into fruity and meaty, nutritious snacks of the everyday. He is Professor Extraordinaire of Early Modern British History at Plymouth University. It's James Daybell. Hello, James.
Hello, Sam. You put me to utter shame. Have you spent the entire summer basically writing that? That was so
impressive. I kind of went into a trance. I suddenly thought, I've got to do something on buckets. And I thought, I can't do a single thing on buckets. So I went into a trance and then 5 minutes later, I'd written seven lines. So there you go.
Right, and I'm basically a bucket full of slimy slops.
Kind of. You're the bucket maker. Well, you're
the bucket maker. Oh, I'm the bucket maker. That makes it all right, doesn't it? Well, you may be wondering, who is that unattributed voice so ably helping Daybell co-pilot this very episode? Well, let's just say that if he were a bucket-related historian, he'd only be the chief fire bucket packet carrier supreme, single-handedly putting out the fires of historical dispute, dousing the flames of dissent from with his. Oh, dear me, that's atrocious, Dabo. Dousing the flames of dissent from his historical pail. Yes, he is the chief firefighter of yesteryear. You've guessed it, it's the famous historical adventurer, Dr. Sam Willis. That was a really shoddy introduction, Sam. I do apologise for that.
It was lyrical but a bit blundered, but it's fine. Guys, we are doing today the history of buckets because it's summer holidays. We wanted to do some summer-themed things, and so buckets, so we're going to do spades next and various other more summery things until the storms of autumn come upon us, and then I think we'll do leaves, James. I think that would be a nice to do.
Leaves and conkers.
So buckets, and principally inspired by the bucket and spade of the beach-going kid, I would say. The beach-going children and how much fun they have with buckets and spades on beaches. So it struck me when I was trying to think of an inspiring topic to do in the summer that we would do buckets and spades, because I did think it was a little bit weird. It's so easy to take for granted what all the kids do on the beach, but it's a kind of level of physical interaction with the environment there from children having a glorious time that you don't really see anywhere else, and you certainly don't see it in old Victorian paintings. So I thought buckets would be an interesting thing to do, and I initially thought about what goes in buckets, rather like our episode on the history of boxes, which is good. You can think about it, about what goes in boxes. But with buckets, it's great stuff because you can do slops, as I mentioned earlier, introducing James, urine, waste, that all links to disease. So you're using buckets rather than running water. I was thinking about bailing buckets on small craft and some fabulous stories about that after ship, about the use of buckets after shipwrecks. So, James, yeah, the contents of buckets was something that sprung to mind.
Oh, nice. I mean, I was also thinking about the hook of the seaside. Seaside, summertime, buckets and spades, sandcastles, crabbing, rock pools, all that sort of invention of the English seaside holiday, Thomas Cook, all that jazz, 19th century invention, you know, which I'm sure you're going to be talking about. And I wanted to do something slightly different. And I got thinking about, you know, uses and types of buckets as well. I talked to my daughter. My daughters are the fount of all historical knowledge. My youngest daughter has an encyclopedic knowledge of everything horrible histories. And so you just go to her with anything and she goes, oh, yes, it's about that. So buckets and urine came up. And I'm going to be talking a little bit about that. But types of different types of buckets and fire buckets, different buckets made out of different kinds of things, so leather buckets or wooden buckets, the rise of metal buckets and the ubiquitous plastic buckets that we have nowadays, and then the different uses. And I think I'm going to be talking about fire buckets, and I found the most extraordinary example, an object that survives in the British Museum, and it's from 1666, and it is a fire bucket that was used during the Great Fire of London to put out the fire. I mean, this was a time.
Oh, I like that.
I'm amazed that it still survives.
Leather?
It is a leather bucket.
Is it leather?
It is a leather bucket, and it was found in a burned-out cellar at the end of Pudding Lane, along with other evidence of the wooden supports for barrels. And it's got the initials SBB on it, so you can sort of identify who it might have belonged to and the date. But it, you know, this is a time when London was, yes, there was some brick, but most of the buildings were timber framed. There was no organized fire brigade, so people basically did the best they could within their local parishes, within the local parish church, and they would use, you know, axes to pull timber down that was burning, and then they would use buckets, you know, and it was handheld buckets that would allow the water to be used to put the fire out. So I was going to talk a little. Well, I've talked about that now. I was also going to talk about urine and buckets, and then I came across some extraordinary ancient buckets and medieval buckets. Have you ever come across situlas? Sort of religious buckets used
never
for...
Never heard of it. Never heard
buckets
of it.
Used for carrying holy water. And there's a wonderful example from the Victorian Albert Museum that has all these amazing biblical carvings all over them. So that's where I'm going to go with all of this.
Very nice. Actually, I talk about different types of buckets. I came across a peat bucket, and very distinctively Irish thing. So you can think of buckets having national character as well. We don't get peat buckets in the UK, but you certainly get them in Ireland. So it's a bucket that goes by your fire where you put your sliced peat, which they burn, so that keeps you warm. And one went sold for like €145,000, a very distinctive Georgian type of peat bucket. And apparently the Irish also have plate buckets, I didn't know about. So these are buckets where you put your plates in. You bring your plates from the kitchen to the fire in the plate bucket, and then the fire warms them up. So Ooh. It's a way of keeping your plates warm before you eat. But why don't we, Jones, let's just do it together. We can talk about the kind of the invention of the seaside and the adoption of the bucket and the spade and the rake as well, quite interestingly. You know, when you get a little bucket and spade set, there's often a little rake in there.
And a sieve.
That's all part of the story. It's all part of the tale. So why don't we just do that together quickly? We could just have a talk about the development of beachside holidays. I suppose we should start off by saying that, you know, there was a time when the only people who were on the beach were the ethnic fishermen, the people who lived there, and they worked in a pretty torrid environment, slaving away against nature to carve out a living. And then there was a moment in the 19th century where you have romantic artists, people like Turner and Constable, and authors and poets who go and enjoy focusing on these people and how they live their lives. And then, because of the art that they produce, it inspires people to go to the seaside to then go and see these ethnic fishing communities. And it's in that kind of link. You've got a sort of cohabitation. You've got two groups of people living together. I suppose there are three. You've got the fishermen, then you've got the artists, and then you've got the travellers. That you get this crossover where fishermen start selling objects and trinkets linked with their trade, which people can take home. And among the things that they sell are spades, buckets and spades. So I don't know if you came across this, James, but it's all to do with the... it's a type of fishing, but it's the act of foraging on the foreshore where the cockler, if you think of a cockler, his tools are a bucket and spade and very often a rake. But it's not just cockles. There are all sorts of other bits and pieces which people are getting from the foreshore, which I think is quite interesting. Sand eels is one which you might have might see nowadays. People using live sand eels to catch sea bass. It's a great fishing bait, but also razorfish, mussels, lava bread, which is essentially seaweed. You've got shrimps and prawns and lugworm and ragworm as well. I'll just stop there, James. But that's an interesting starting point, I think, for the seaside holiday.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's there's really the sort of it's the invention of the British seaside resort, isn't it? And you think about how you think about places like Bath, sort of spa towns like that that were connected with health. And from the 18th century onwards, I think that extends into coastal areas, and coastal areas now are associated with health and well-being and going and sort of breathing the fresh air and swimming in the sea and all of that if it's not too polluted. So that's really where it all starts. And then we can sort of follow it through the sort of the rise of the holiday. We can connect it to the growth of railways, the way in which, you know, particular firms like Thomas Cook were set up in order to take people away and give them access to you know, leisure breaks and to holidays. And then you've got the sort of development of seaside towns in terms of architecture, in terms of gardens and public spaces. You've got the contraptions associated with bathing. So you can think of bathing machines and beach huts and all of those kinds of things that I think are part and parcel of what we would see as a traditional British seaside holiday. In the 19th century, you've got the invention of piers, you know, that allow people to, you know, walk along them to go out to sea and to, you know, and to sort of enjoy themselves and, you know, in various sort of things. You know, there are apparently over, by 1914, over 100 pleasure piers in Britain, you know, dotted with all sorts of, you know, attractions for people to go and enjoy. And supposedly about 55 surviving piers in England and Wales to this very day, according to the National Pier Society, as I read here. So yes, that's nothing to do with the bucket and spade. But I imagine as you,
well, you know, it's kind of like the next. It's the next. It's bit, this next chapter, yeah, on, isn't it?
I mean,
yeah.
Family holidays, children on the beach, needing to entertain them. You know,
but yeah, and the history of how you understand that is actually quite interesting. And art is a really good way of getting into it. And there's one particular painting by William Dyce of Pegwell Bay in Kent. It's from 1859, and it's believed to be the first visual representation of children sitting on a beach using buckets and spades. There's also donkeys and various other kind of tropes that you will associate with holidays. But this is 1859, which I think is that's a very interesting date for all of this to be happening, because it's significantly on from the 1840s when you've got the first, really, the 1830s, 1840s, the first contact between the Romantic artists and the ethnic community. So it allowed people to kind of get it into their heads that this is what they want to be doing. It's allowed the cultures to change so that you can go to a beach and you can stay with fishermen. And fishermen is like a kind of early Victorian Airbnb. They're staying with them, they're taking them out on fishing trips, they're selling them tools of their trade. And among these tools, of course, is the bucket. And they're often made out of driftwood. They've got all the skills because they can mend ships. Ships' hulls are curved, buckets are curved. They can do it, and then they can sell it. Then you think about what people are actually doing with the buckets. Now, this is interesting. So I've talked about gathering shellfish and stuff. So this is a kind of a reenactment of the local fisher folk, or some of them who weren't actually taken to the sea, but they were scouring the foreshore. But also, kids nowadays use the buckets to mould castles, to make sand castles, and that's like a completely different aspect to the whole history of it. James, you just mentioned very distinctive coastal architecture of piers there, but it's easy for us to forget the fact that if you go to somewhere like Brighton or wherever it might be, there is significant coastal architecture. In 1859, there wasn't. All there was small fishing villages and then enormous military works and castles. So military works in the 19th century, 18th century, Napoleonic Wars, and then huge coastal castles from the 13th century or so, a bit before some of them, 12th century or even the 11th, like the castle at Dover. And so the association, which has been is made very clear actually by artists like Turner, of castles with the beach is made very clear. So it's not random that people are making castles with their buckets. There is a clear association of Britain being an island nation that has all these military defences that protects it from invasion. So that's kind of what people are doing even today.
Oh, love that. I mean, I think there's also a material history of these buckets and spades. I was having a look at the Museum of Childhood, which is a wonderful museum in London, part of the V&A and the Museum of London. And they have there in the childhood galleries on the first floor displays are not only just party games, but also of seaside accoutrements. You know, so bathing costumes that children would have worn, but also vintage buckets and spades. And I also found an example of a child's seaside rubber bucket and spade, a Canon rubber product, registered design numbers 6, 863276, which is a sort of speckled white. It's white with speckled yellow, blue and red bits all over it, dating from 1957. So we've got the sort of the artifacts there themselves that survive. And I think you can trace a history of that design, you know, back, and which has a really interesting history in itself, in all sorts of variations and sizes and shapes that are connected to, you know, scientific technologies, which is why the Science Museum has an example of this sort of rubber bucket design rather than a plastic one. And also the sort of much earlier vintage ones that I think are really interesting. Whether children are involved in this, or whether there is competitive sandcastle making. I mean, I was down at the beach the other day at Bantham, which is one of my favourite beaches in Devon, a superb beach, and the spectacular sandcastles that I saw on the beach there, including a mock-up of Stonehenge in sand.
Whoa.
You know, there's some real competitive stuff. But then there's the idea of whether are sandcastles for children or are they for adults? Oh, the jury's out, I'm afraid, Sam.
Who knows? Who knows what's going on? But it is certainly to do with people thinking about their environment and their history, even whether they're not doing it consciously. But they are. So you've got to celebrate people making castles with their buckets. I also came across this wonderful quote. I tell you, the past is a bucket of ashes. So live not in your yesterdays, not just for tomorrow, but in the here and now. Keep moving and forget the postmortems. And remember, no one can get the jump on the future. By the Carl Sandburg, the American poet, around 1868. He was nearly 100, actually, when he died. But I love that idea of the past being a bucket of ashes. And it made me think of famous fires, where literally the past became a bucket of ashes. And one of the most, I suppose, the famous ones here. And this is all to do with historical sources. It's not a general point about historical fires. This is historical fires when historical records were destroyed. And so I think one of the best examples comes from the summer of 1922 and the Battle of Dublin. So it's a week of street battles fought in Dublin that marks the beginning of that Irish Civil War. And this is after the Anglo-Irish Treaty. That ends what had been the Irish War of Independence. And they start fighting again. You've got the new provincial government and a section of the IRA that are opposing the treaty. And they fight, they riot, and there is an enormous explosion at the Public Record Office in Dublin. And it destroys much of Ireland's documentary heritage, dating back to the 13th century. And there's a little quote here from the Irish Times that those precious records, which would have been so useful to the future historian, have been devoured by the flames or scattered in fragments by the four winds of heaven. And the losses there, which were particularly acute, were for late medieval Irish history, and particularly the wonderful medieval chancery rolls. So these are all outgoing letters, all to do with the Secretariat of the Kings of England. And the relationship with Ireland, and the majority of them were burned. But it took a fairly recent, a decade or so old, online project to source copies or sort of mentions as well of these lost documents in other archives around the UK and also Europe, and to put them all online. So you can now find them. It's called CIRCLE, C-I-R-C-L-E. It's the Irish Chancery Project, and it's worth having a look at there, where they've recovered, certainly a lot of the content, if not the documents themselves, were destroyed in that terrible fire in the summer of 1922.
Oh, they came along to Plymouth to a research seminar that I organised and talked to us about the project. It's really, really fascinating. It's all about the way in which they have reconstructed those long-lost documents. Absolutely fascinating. Now, I wanted to take us in... My next thing that I'm going to talk about was, in fact, related to the coastline. So it sticks with that. And it's connected to the Yorkshire coastline in particular. And if you go up to that sort of part of Yorkshire, up around Whitby and that sort of area, what's incredible is that there are these large chunks that seem to have sort of been bitten out of the coastline. You know, there are all sorts of scars there. And this is related to quarrying for alum. Now, alum, as you probably know, is something that was mined in that area from about 1600 into the middle of the 19th century, because alum is really important for dyeing. It's in fact a dye fixative. Now, this is a commodity that was used. There is a connection to buckets in a minute, but that's sort of long preamble until we get there. So alum has for a long time been really important for this very sort of purpose. We can find evidence of it in the Roman Empire. For much of the period, there is a monopoly on it. It's controlled by the papacy. We have to import much of it into the British Isles. But then in the 16th century, Thomas Challoner found that fossils in the shale along this part of the coastline of Yorkshire had alum in them. And so what you have is the establishment of the alum industry there. Now, this is where the bucket comes in, because the process of creating alum means that basically in order to get it out, you have to use ammonia and roast kelp for potassium. And the biggest source of ammonia during that period was, of course, urine. So massive, massive amounts of urine were needed. And it was estimated that around 200 tons of urine was used per year at the height of the alum industry. And this is literally the urine from 1,000 people for the entire year. Can you imagine sort of carrying that? And it's quite a sort of convoluted sort of way in which it works, because it takes about 9 months. So the alum is extracted from the sort of the shale, and it's quite a complicated process. It involves burning huge piles of shale, you know, for about 9 months, and then you transfer it into leaching pits in order to get out the aluminium sulfate, which is what you're after. And this is then sent along channels to the alum works, where urine is added. And so this is how alum is sort of in this sort of solution, and then it's extracted. And there's a really odd way in which you know when this very unsavoury liquor is ready to lift out the alum crystals, and you know that it's ready when you can float an egg in it. So that's the test for it. But what I'm interested in is how you get all of this urine. Now, one of the things that they do is they set up a public urinal in Hull, so a public toilet is built so that they are able to, you know, get hold of the urine and transport it. It's also supposed to be shipped in from as far away as Newcastle. But also, and here's the thing, also people started, there was a drive for people to actually collect their own urine. And so buckets were put out on street corners and people would, you know, would urinate in them. And then it would be, you know, picked up and carried off and taken to the alum factory where it would be, or the alum processing place where it would be used for this purpose, which is where the phrase taking the piss comes from, or one of the reasons where taking the piss comes from. So there we are. The use of buckets to carry urine, to extract alum from shale, which connects to the coastline of North Yorkshire.
Wonderful
How
stuff.
How about that for a connection? Yeah.
Very, very impressive. Well, we're nearly at the end of our history of buckets, James. Have you got any more?
I have a lovely bucket that I was going to talk to you about, which is going to talk to you about a different kind of bucket, which is these are sort of rare ancient artifacts or objects, and these are situlas. And there are thousands of them that survive. These are archaeological finds. They're often grave goods, so you can trace them back to the Etruscan period, sort of 600 to 550 BC, where they're found in tombs. There are a lot of Roman bronze examples. They are highly decorated, so there are all sorts of motifs on them, and reliefs and imagery and inscriptions. What I'm really interested in, though, is when they get adopted by Christian religion, and there are a whole range of highly intricate examples here. And one of the most interesting ones that I came across is an example from the Victorian Albert Museum, which is absolutely extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary. It's called the Basilewski Situla, and it's dated from roughly 980 to 981. And it was made out of ivory, and it was supposed to carry holy water. And I don't know whether you've ever been to a sort of a Catholic church or Catholic mass and seen a very sort of high church and seen the way in which often the bishop would have a sort of a bucket of water, of holy water, and then would have a sort of rod that would be dipped in it. And as he'd walk up and down the aisle, he would just flick water over the congregation, so sort of anointing them with holy water by sort of, you know, a sort of scattergun approach. That's exactly what this was. And it was produced at the time of the visit of the Emperor Otto II to Milan with his third wife, Theophanu, and his infant son, who became Otto III. And it's one of about three situlas from the Ottonian period that have survived in various places. But what's remarkable about this is the imagery that appears on it. It's not particularly big. If you have a look in diameter, it's about just over 10 centimetres in diameter. So it's not particularly big. If you put your sort of hands together and make a circle, it's roughly that. It's about at the top, it's about 12 centimetres in diameter. And its height is only about 17.8 centimetres. I say only. That's quite a precise measurement, measured by curators, by a curatorial team. But it depicts 12 scenes from the Passion and Resurrection of Christ. And these are arranged in two rows. And the upper row shows pictures of Christ washing the disciples' feet, the betrayal of Christ, Judas accepting 30 pieces of silver, etc., etc. And in the lower row, you've got the harrowing of hell, Christ appearing to the women, Christ appearing to the apostles, the incredulity of St. Thomas. And then you have three bands of inscription. And the inscription, there are various sort of different translations of it. One of them, I think, is basically reminding the bishop of Milan to sort of, you know, venerate the sort of this vessel which the Holy Caesar, in other words, the emperor, has given him in order to, you know, use during the service. So this is an extraordinary piece that survives, you know, from the 10th century. We can situate it within a particular historical context. We can talk about the way in which it has been produced. So we can talk about the technology, the carving. We can look at the imagery on it, and we can connect it to not only imperial power, but also to the power of the Catholic Church at the time. All of that comes out of the perspective of the history of the bucket, Sam Willis, would you believe? Incredible, isn't it?
Amazing. Yeah, extraordinary. And there's so much more you can also find out about, not least the murder of one of his crewmen by William Kidd, who actually smashed him over the head with a bucket. And if you're interested in any pirate stories, do please check out the history of William Kidd, because it's definitely the best one. That's it for now, though. We're going to come back to you. I think we might do spades next, James. I think that would be an appropriate thing for us to do.
Spades and seagulls, we should do.
Well, two, a double one, spades and seagulls. That's it for now, though. Please follow me on social media. I'm at Dr. Sam Willis. And if you're interested in maritime history, we've talked a little bit about the seaside today. Please listen to the Mariner's Mirror podcast.
And you can follow me on social media at James Daybell. You can follow the podcast at Unexpected Pod. We are also on Facebook and Instagram. And also check out our webpage, historiesoftheunexpected.com, for all our back catalogue, what we've been up to, magazine articles about all the things that we podcast about, and also signed copies of our books. And also, look out, very exciting, a paperback edition of Histories of the Unexpected comes out in October. I'm very, very excited about that. If you'd like to support us, head over to patreon.com and our page there, Histories of the Unexpected, and you can help us change the way in which people think about the past. But meanwhile, hope that you are enjoying the summer sun wherever you are. Take care, guys.
Cheerio, bye-bye.